Dusty. There is. E.T. Thus. Na. Not. Dusty. There is. Iti. Thus. Cha. And. Vastu nishtayo. Professing knowledge of the ultimate cause. Ekastayo. With one and the same subject matter. Establishing Brahman. Pina. Demonstrating different. Virudha dharmano. And opposing characteristics. Avikshitam. Perceived. Kanchana. That something which. Yoga sankhyayoho. Of mystic yoga and the Sankhya philosophy. Analysis of the ways of nature. Samam. The same. Param. Transcendental. He. Indeed. Anukulam. Dwelling place. Brihat tat. That ultimate cause. Translation and purport. There are two parties, namely the theists and the atheists. The theists, who accept the supersoul, finds the spiritual cause through mystic yoga. The Sankhyite, however, who merely analyzes the material elements, comes to a conclusion of impersonalism and does not accept a supreme cause, whether Bhagavan, Paramatma, or even Brahman. Instead, he is preoccupied with the superfluous external activities of material nature. Ultimately, however, both parties demonstrate the absolute truth, because although they offer opposing statements, their object is the same ultimate cause. They are both approaching the same supreme Brahman, to whom I offer my respectful obeisances. Purport, actually, there are two sides to this argument. Some say that the absolute has no form, Nirakara. And others say that the absolute has form, Sakara. Therefore, the word form is the common factor. Although some accept it, Asti or Astika, whereas others try to negate it, Nasti or Nastika. Since the devotees consider the word form, Akara, the common factor for both, he offers his respectful obeisances to the form, although others may go on arguing about whether the absolute has form or not. In this verse, the word yoga sankhyayo is very important. Yoga means bhakti yoga because yogis also accept the existence of the all-pervading supreme soul and try to see that supreme soul within their hearts. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 12.13.1, dhyanavishtita tad gyatena manasa Pashanti yam yoginaha. The devotee tries to come directly in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whereas the yogi tries to find the supersoul within the heart by meditation. Thus, both directly and indirectly, yoga means bhakti yoga. Sankhya, however, means physical study of the cosmic situation through speculative knowledge. This is generally known as jnana shastra. The Sankhyites are attached to the impersonal Brahman, but the absolute truth is known in three ways. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavan iti, Shabdayate. The absolute truth is one, but some accept him as impersonal Brahman, some as the supersoul existing everywhere, and some as Bhagavan, the supreme personality of Godhead, the central personality of Godhead. The central point is the absolute truth. Although the impersonalists and personalists fight with one another, they focus upon the same Parabrahman, the same absolute truth. In the Yoga Shastras, Krishna is described as follows: Krishnam Pishangambaram Ambhujakshanam Chaturbhujam Sankhya Gadad Yudhar Yudham. Thus, the pleasing appearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's bodily features, his limbs, and his dress are described. The Sankhya Shastra, however, denies the existence of the Lord's transcendental form. The Sankhya Shastra says that the Supreme Absolute Truth has no hands, no legs, and no name. Hyanama rupa guna pani padam Achakshur Ashrotram Ekam Advityam Apinama Arupadikam Nasti. The Vedic mantra says, Apani Pado Javano Grahita. The Supreme Lord has no legs and hands, but he can accept whatever is offered to him. Actually, such statements accept that the Supreme has hands and legs, but deny that he has material hands and legs. This is why the Absolute is called Aprakrita. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has a Satchit Ananda Vigraha, a form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss, not a material form. The Sankhyites, or Jnanis, deny the material form, and the devotees also know very well that the Absolute Truth, Bhagavan, has no material form. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadi Radhir Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the Supreme Controller. He has an eternal, blissful spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin, for he is the prime cause of all causes. End quote. The conception of the Absolute without hands and legs and the conception of the Absolute with hands and legs are apparently contradictory, but they both coincide with the same truth about the Supreme Absolute Person. Therefore, the word Vastunishtayo, which is used herein, indicates that both the yogis and the Sankhyites have faith in the reality, but are arguing about it from different viewpoints of material and spiritual identities. Parabrahman, or Brihat, is the common point. The Sankhyites and yogis are both situated in the same Brahman, but they differ because of different angles of vision. The directions given by the Bhakti Shastra point one in the perfect direction, because the Supreme Personality of Godhead says in Bhagavad Gita, Bhaktya mam abhijanati, quote, only by devotional service am I to be known, end quote. The bhaktas know that the Supreme Person has no material form, whereas the jnanis simply deny the material form. One should therefore take shelter of the bhakti marg, the path of devotion. Then everything will be clear. Jnanis concentrate on the virat rupa, the gigantic universal form of the Lord. This is a good system in the beginning for those who are extremely materialistic, but there is no need to think continuously of the virat rupa. When Arjuna was shown the virat rupa of Krishna, he saw it, but he did not want to see it perpetually. He therefore requested the Lord to return to his original form as two-armed Krishna. In conclusion, learned scholars find no contradictions in the devotee's concentration upon the spiritual form of the Lord, Ishvara Sarva Parama Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha. In this regard, Srila Madhvacharya says that less intelligent non-devotees think that their conclusion is the ultimate. But because devotees are completely learned, they can understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the ultimate goal. Long purport. Okay, so we're continuing the Hungsuguya prayers. There's this theme going on about how it's not so easy to see or to understand the Supreme Lord, and this theme is kind of being continued here in this verse, in coming verses, and in previous verses. Jiva Goswami said that in order to begin to understand God, one needs to understand that God is inconceivable. That's like the beginning point of understanding God. And then those who accept that, they can progress nicely, and those who don't, they struggle. Also, it's said that even if you're a great muni, very learned, and you can travel at the speed of the mind, millions of times the speed of the mind, you'll not be able to understand just the tip of the toenail of Mahavishnu. So no matter how much we try with our own efforts, with tapasya, studying scriptures or whatever, Krishna's always just beyond our reach. So the Vedas mostly deal with the karma kandya, just rituals aimed at elevation to heavenly planets. That's a large portion of the Vedas. And then there's a smaller portion of the Vedas, the Upanishads, which deal with the spirit soul, the absolute truth. And the Upanishads, they're very I guess you could say it, there's a lot of very terse statements. The language is very terse. They put a lot of meaning in very short aphorisms. There's volumes and volumes of meanings in just short aphorisms. So and not everybody can understand the Upanishads very clearly because there's just so much there. It's hard to understand. And also the Upanishads, they tend to also use the process of natinati to describe the absolute truth. Natinati is like the negation, like going in depth descriptions of the negative aspects of material nature. So they'll try to distinguish the difference between matter and spirit by saying that spirit is, if you take away all the material qualities of something, what you have left is spirit. So then they have this whole analysis where they say, okay, well, all material forms have variety and differentiation. So if we remove all variety and all differentiation, then we'll see, oh, okay, then that is something spiritual, something which is without variety, formless. So they come to, oftentimes people, when they read these statements, they come to the conclusion that the absolute truth is impersonal. It's not, it's formless. And that's one of the two parties described here. So they accept the absolute truth as nirakara, as without having form. And Prabhupada describes them here as atheists. So they tend to have like a, they tend to analyze the physical elements of the universe and try to understand through, you know, there's mental speculation about the absolute truth. And they come to this conclusion that the Supreme is formless. That there is no cause, that the Supreme is formless. And they tend to focus on the negative parts of the statements of the Upanishads. Like he has no legs, no hands, no form, you know, things like that. And then there's another group called the theists, and they accept that the Supreme Absolute Truth has form, sakara, and that there is a cause. And then they because they accept that there's a form, they accept that the Lord has satchit ananda vigraha, you know, is spiritual, has a form. Then they offer obeisances to the Lord. They offer devotion. They perform, engage in devotional service. And it's said here that both of these parties, they're actually approaching the same absolute truth. And they're seeing it, it's described later, that they're seeing it from different angles of vision. So those who accept that the absolute truth does not have a form, they might be seeing the more Brahman aspect of the absolute truth, the form which is kind of formless, meaning it has no material form. And then, whereas the devotees or the yogis, they are seeing more like trying to see the Bhagavan feature. So I guess you can also think of like that common, I guess, analogy of five blind men trying to understand what an elephant is. So there's five blind men and they can't see the elephant, but they're touching different parts of the elephant. And by touching a certain part of the elephant, they get a certain conception of what the elephant is like. So one of them might be touching the, like, just like the stomach of the elephant. They might think, oh, wow, this is like a big wall. And that's their conception of an elephant. It's just a big wall. And whereas another one might be touching the tail of the elephant, and they might be thinking, oh, an elephant's like a rope or something. So anyway, everybody is seeing different aspects of the elephant. Therefore, they have a certain understanding of what it's like. They're right, but they're also not right because they don't see the whole picture. So that's kind of like that when it comes to these different devotees seeing the absolute truth. They see it from different angles of vision. So it seems a little contradictory, maybe. Like if, you know, here we hear about the Lord having form, sakara, and also not having form, nirakara. So the Lord has form and does not have form, and yet they're both, and those who see that way, they're both seeing the same absolute truth. So it seems that's A little difficult to understand. Seems a little bit like double talk. But there's the Vedas or the Upanishads, especially they use this, I guess, way of presenting the absolute truth multiple times. So you'll see in the Isha-Upanishad that it says that the Lord walks and he does not walk. He is within, and he's within everything, and he's also outside of everything. He's very near and he's very far. You know, he has no legs, no hands, no eyes, but yet he can surpass all others running, and he accepts whatever's offered to him. So there's all this, like, you know, seemingly opposing statements about the absolute truth. And if you accept both of these statements, you know, both he walks and he does not walk, and other statements, then you're a devotee. But if you accept only one of these statements, one of these two opposing statements, either you're an impersonalist or you're a sentimentalist. So the idea is that, let's take the example of he's fixed in his abode. You know, it's said that the Lord is fixed in his abode, but yet he's present everywhere. So we can take this example. So somebody who might, you know, only accept that he's fixed in his abode, part of the statement, he's a sentimentalist. So they'll think, oh, the Lord is only in the temple, you know, and he's not anywhere else. So they come, they see only the Lord in the temple. So this is a sentimentalist person. But those who accept that the Lord is everywhere, and he's not especially present in the temple, he's an impersonalist. Because the Lord is especially personally present in the temple. The Lord appears as his archivigraha form. Legitimate. The Lord appears. He's act personally there. All the potencies that we find in the holy name are also there in the deity. Sometimes people don't always understand the deity form of the Lord. Sometimes they say that the Lord is in the deities. So this is not quite a proper understanding of the deities. It's rather that the Lord is the deities. The deities is the Lord. The Lord accepts a form of like material elements so that we can see and perceive and, you know, serve him. So one might have a question, like, why did Prabhupada introduce deity worship in our movement? You know, our movement is a preaching movement, but yet Prabhupada emphasized that we should also engage in deity worship. And deity worship is it's a difficult thing. It takes a lot of time and energy and a lot of resources, and it's a very big part of our life. But our movement is a preaching movement, so why did Prabhupada also stress deity worship? The answer is that, you know, especially for neophyte devotees, it's very important to develop a personal connection with Krishna, and deity worship helps us to develop that personal connection with Krishna. And, you know, we can't see the Lord with our eyes, but at least we can see the deities. And so, like that, Krishna likes to give his mercy to those who don't have spiritual vision. So that's why he appears in the deity form, so that others can see him and worship him. So, anyway, nevertheless, so even though the idea is that even though the Lord might appear in so-called material elements, he's still nirguna. He's without material qualities, and he's nirakara, without material form. So one might have a question, well, if that's true, then what about, you know, like if like a deity's fingers get broken or, you know, damaged, or the paint chips off the deities, how is that spiritual? You know, we're saying the Lord has no material qualities, but yet it seems like the deities are exhibiting material qualities by breaking, you know, getting so-called damaged. So how do we understand that? The answer is that it depends on the devotion of the person. You know, he can see it. So a nice example of this is there's a little pastime between Anantacharya and Lord Balaji. So the Alwars, they're like great, you know, saints and poets from the Sri Vaishnava tradition. They sing the glories of the Lord of the Seven Hills, who's Balaji. They sing the glories of the Lord of the Seven Hills. And then Ramanujacharya, he was hearing about the glories of the Lord of the Seven Hills from the Alwars, and he was wanting to start the worship of the Lord of the Seven Hills, Balaji. So he had a meeting with all the acharyas of that time, and he asked them all, if any of them would be willing to go up and serve the Lord of the Seven Hills on a daily basis every day for the rest of your life. This is just what you do. And all of them were a little hesitant because, you know, it would mean that it's a very hard life. Up in the hills, it's a little dangerous. There's, you know, you're kind of living in the forest. There's tigers and malaria, and it's like not an easy life. So some of them were hesitant to accept this offer from Ramanujacharya. But there was one amongst them who, he's, you know, strong and silent devotee. He stood up and he said, "Beloved Acharya, I would please bless me with this opportunity to serve the Lord of the Seven Hills. You know, bless this soul to be able to do that. With your grace, I want to take up this service." And then Ramanujacharya was very pleased with Anantacharya. So then Anantacharya, he, you know, started worshiping the Balaji up on the hill. So Balaji is known for really liking flowers. He really likes flowers and flower garlands. And so Anantacharya always used to serve him in that way. He always used to, you know, select very nice flowers and make flower garlands and decorate the Balaji with flowers every day. And he didn't do it as a matter of duty. He did it out of intense love. And he really, really loved serving the Lord. And he was, another thing about Anantacharya is that he didn't like others to interfere with his service. So he liked to do it himself. He liked to do things himself to serve the Lord. So one day he got this inspiration that, I'm making flower garlands every day for the Lord. He got this insight, maybe I should build a garden, grow a garden. That way I can grow flowers and it would help in serving the Lord. And then, so he immediately wanted to implement it. So I can relate to this. You know, if you get like an idea, you just immediately want to implement it. So Anantacharya was a little bit like that. He got an idea and he started right away. But it was a service between the Lord and himself. He didn't want others to participate. Not even a fly could come in between him and his service. So he was growing the garden, and then at one point he wanted to make like a well or a lake in the garden. So he was digging out mud and stuff to make a lake. And at that point he did allow his wife to help out a little, but only his wife and only for this particular part of the service. So he would dig out the mud from the earth, and then the wife would take the mud and throw it away. So that's it. And another thing was that it was kind of a laborious task. It wasn't so easy to dig a lake, especially for, you know, Anantacharya's wife. And Anantacharya's wife also happened to be pregnant, too. So this made it especially tough for her. And Anantacharya was aware of the suffering of it, that his wife was going through, throwing this mud away from the lake. But she didn't complain. She was very happy to help her husband in his spiritual act. So anyway, this was going on for some time, and then there's this 12-year-old boy who came and asked Anantacharya, "Can I help? I see you're doing something. I would love to help. Can I help?" And Anantacharya got angry because he said, "No, you very bluntly refused. You cannot help." So then the 12-year-old boy kind of... Anyway, I think maybe Anantacharya might have even chased the boy away. Like, "Go away," and then the boy ran off. So then the boy again came back the next day and said, "Can I help? You know, there seems like something to be done." And every time the boy was coming, Anantacharya kept saying, "No, you cannot help." And then finally the boy, feeling compassion, especially for Anantacharya's wife, seeing that she was pregnant and wanting to help, he decided to help anyway without asking the permission from Anantacharya. So while Anantacharya was throwing the mud out of the hole, and he decided to help the wife throw the mud away from the lake. And then when Anantacharya came up from the hole, he saw that, "Wow, the mud's gone. How did you do this so quickly, my dear wife?" And then she had to say that, "Well, this boy was helping me, you know, carry the mud away." And then Anantacharya he got really angry because he did not want anybody to help other than his wife. So then he started chasing that boy. But the boy was faster than Anantacharya, so the boy kind of was at a distance in front of him. And then, kind of out of desperation, Anantacharya took his digging tool and he threw it at the boy. And he hit the boy in the chin, and the boy's chin started bleeding. And Anantacharya felt good about it. You know, he felt that that boy deserved it. He did not feel remorse at all. So anyway, the story goes that the next morning, the priests in that who were helping to worship Balaji, they noticed that the deity's chin was oozing blood, that the deity was hurt. And then when they told Anantacharya, he immediately realized, "Oh, that was the Lord who I just, you know, threw with my digging instrument." So he felt bad and he apologized. But the Lord, he wasn't offended by any means. He actually took it as a sign of Anantacharya's love for him. And, you know, I guess he told Anantacharya or something that, you know, "I'm going to have this mark here as a token of your love for me. And every day you can put chandan on it to help ease the pain." So you'll notice if you look at the Balaji deity, there's this little white mark on his chin. So that's the story behind how that white mark got there. So it might seem like there's a seeming defect, you know, like, "Oh, the deities have a broken chin or something," but there's actually, it's totally spiritual. And the story continues that the, so now after this incident, Anantacharya got like renewed vigor to complete the garden, growing the garden project. So he, you know, eventually it kind of took shape and it was looking very, very nice. He put a lot of devotion into this garden. He, you know, poured his love on every single plant and, you know, flower and blossom and bud. He knew every plant in his garden, and he was very like meticulous about everything. And it was so nice that the Lord Balaji and his wife Lakshmi wanted to go and enjoy the garden. So one night they decided to go and just have enjoy in the garden. And at one point the Balaji picked one of the flowers and offered it to Lakshmi. And anyway, they had their pastime. So then the next morning, Anantacharya came into the garden and he noticed that some of the flowers were plucked, and that it looked like somebody was in the garden. So he got upset. He got really upset. Who would dare enter the garden, which is meant exclusively for the Lord? And so he decided that he's going to stay up all night and try to catch whoever did this. So he stayed up all night without sleeping and guarded the garden. And even though he stayed up all night, he noticed that when the next day came, some of the flowers were again gone, and it looked like somebody was walking around or something. So he's like, "I was up and I saw it, and still it happened." So he decided, "I'm going to stay up again." And then he did this for 8 nights in a row, just trying to guard the garden from anybody entering. But every time he failed. He wasn't able to catch whoever did it. So anyway, after some time, the Lord decided, okay, I'm going to allow Anantacharya to catch us this time. So then, sure enough, he was waiting, and then some husband and the wife came into the garden, and Anantacharya said, oh, yes, I got you, and then started, like, running after them, and he caught a hold of both of them, and he tried to, like, get some revenge for you trespassing on my garden. So somehow Balaji was able to, like, wiggle out of his grasp, and he kind of ran away, but Anantacharya still had the wife. And while the Balaji was running away, Anantacharya kept hold of the wife, and he was thinking, okay, well, the husband's going to come back for the wife, I know, so I'm going to keep the wife here, and then the husband will come back, and when the husband comes back, I'll get my revenge. So he decided to tie up the wife on a tree with some vines. And then, anyways, so then the next morning came, and the priests were shocked and dumbfounded when they saw the deities, or when they saw Lord Balaji, and they saw Lord Balaji, but Lakshmi was missing. You know, Lakshmi resides on the chest of Lord Balaji. You'll see the deity. But she was gone. Where was she? And then, you know, Lord Balaji said to them, I guess, oh, Lakshmi, she's in Anantacharya's garden. Anyway, again, Anantacharya, he felt bad. Oh, geez, I kind of kidnapped Lakshmi. So anyway, so there's two kind of stories which these show that the deity form is nirguna and nirakara. It's not a material form with material qualities, although it might look like it from a certain angle of vision. So anyway, why are these contradictions here? One could ask that question. Because we have... We really need to kind of revise our deep-rooted material conceptions about the absolute truth. So the Upanishads, they'll say, like, the Lord has no eyes. Because generally when we think... if the Lord has eyes, we think eyes like ours, eyes like this. And we think, oh, the Lord might have eyes like ours. But actually, it should be the other way around. We say that we have eyes like the Lord. You know, you don't say that that the father looks like the child. We say that the child looks like the father. You know, so similarly, we look like the Lord in one sense. That'd be more appropriate. So that's kind of like how we can begin to understand. And there's also like all these contradictions that are there, that are mentioned, like he has form and he doesn't have a form, or he's within everything yet he's outside of everything. There's ways we can understand this. Like he's within everything as super soul, and he's also outside of everything as the Virat Rupa. Or he's very near and he's very far. So he's very near to those who want to be near to him. And also as the super soul, he's as close to you as you can get. And he's very far for those who want to be very far away from him. And he walks and he doesn't walk. You know, there are examples of deities that are walking. The Sakshi Gopal example. So anyway, like this, there's ways of understanding these apparent double talk. Of course, to really be able to understand these things, though, it really requires to engage in devotional service. We can accept that the Lord has these inconceivable powers and he can do amazing things. We can accept that, and we can also hear from peer devotees, and that'll help us to begin to start realizing these things instead of just having theoretical understanding. We can't say that we've totally realized these things yet. Maybe we could say that some glimpse of realization is starting to awaken, but we can continue to keep looking in that direction. So continuing to chant in the proper mood and hearing from peer devotees, engaging in devotional service. That's what we can do. Okay, so I'll stop here. Is there anything anybody would like to add? Luke? Or
I was gonna say, this verse gives a nice expression of non-sectarianism, in that everyone is actually worshiping an absolute, and the reason persons don't see that is because there are different perceptions according to the process that they follow. So there's really nothing to argue about, because I think in the previous verse it was talking about how everyone's arguing and disagreeing with each other and so on. But there's really nothing to argue about because everyone's talking about the same truth. The only difference is that there's a level of completeness in their expressions. So one expression may be less complete than another expression, but they're all talking about the absolute truth, the same absolute truth. And so there's really nothing to argue about. And according to the process that you take, you can get a certain completeness of that same truth. So this for me is expressing a nice idea of why a devotee is non-sectarian. And mainly, and he's called as a Mahatma. Prabhupada says Mahatma means one who's broad-minded. So when you become more and more broad-minded, your conception can accommodate all sorts of other ideas, and it can feature other things also that those other ideas may be lacking. So in this sense, a devotee really has nothing to argue about with anyone. And yet you do see devotees arguing, because Prabhupada says this argument is always going on between the atheists and... Because all the devotees, I was trying to reconcile that as I was hearing the discussion, that they will argue with others also because there are different results of different types of worship of the Absolute. So if you worship the Absolute in the form of matter, you get a result that's material, and that's the cause of suffering. So atheists will disregard the experience of consciousness and superconsciousness and a world of consciousness and so on, thus convincing people and just absorbing themselves in the elements of matter. And thus they continue stuck in samsara. So then devotees will argue with that because of their compassion for people suffering due to their absorption in the elements of some matter. So they will argue with people, say, no, there is another conception that's more complete. Not discounting whatever is there that the atheists are saying, but there's something more to be considered in the discussion. There's consciousness. There's something beyond consciousness. And that way giving people a prospect beyond the world of suffering. So that's why I was getting that sort of appreciate.
Yeah, very nice. Thanks. Yeah, because we're kind of duty-bound as devotees to, if we see, you know, yeah, in one sense, okay, everybody is worshiping the Lord, so we could just say, oh, everybody's worshiping the Lord, there's no need to preach, no need to talk to anybody. But at the same time, as devotees, we're duty-bound to preach to people and to tell them, oh, hey, you're worshiping the Lord, but you're worshiping in not a complete way. So there's this whole other realm that you can get into. I remember one time I was driving Dhanavir Maharaj to, I don't know, downtown or whatever for his visa or something, and there's this bhakta he was traveling with who happened to be like this Buddhist guy. And he was saying, you know, Dhanavir Maharaj, he likes to engage in conversations like giving theoretical scenarios and asking us how we would respond to different scenarios. So we were in the car, he was saying, okay, well, what if somebody says that, I think it's okay just to be like a good person. You know, being a good person is, I think that's okay. It's good enough to be a good person. There's no need to do all these other things. As long as you're a good person, I think that's... So if maybe at the end of my life or something, I'll do some devotional service or something along those lines. So then he was putting this scenario forward to us and saying, okay, how would we as devotees respond to this? And then the guy who ended up becoming a Buddhist, or the devotee who was there, he said, well, what to say to such people? You know, it seemed like they're already convinced, there's nothing we can say, so we could just chant Hare Krishna, give him some prasadam, and, you know, that's it. That was his answer. And then Dhanavir Maharaj kind of blasted him for that. He said, no, If we don't say anything, nobody's going to say anything. It's our duty as devotees to, if we see something like this, we have to step in and try to correct it. So, anyway, so like that, if we see somebody worshiping, you know, only in not accepting God or something spiritual or anything, it's our duty to step in and say something. Otherwise, nobody will. And so, anyway, just one thing I missed.
By the sense of concern that although you're all worshiping the same absolute truth, but this one leads you to a result that will not be a very palatable experience for you, namely repeated birth and death. And therefore, your prospect is higher. You know, here's some other information that you could use. I'm thinking of this Chaitanya Charitamrita verse where it says, everyone is a servant of Vishnu. Some know it, some don't. But for those who don't, they have to suffer the consequences of their simple reactions. Yeah. Always like that verse.
Yeah. And don't you also say that everybody's following the Vedas, or those who follow the Vedas and those who don't, they both prove the Vedas to be true. You know, I think I think he said that. Oh, Donnikit. Oh, okay. Okay, anything else? Okay, we'll end here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.